Welcome to Starfleet Universe Encore. I am Paul Franz, owner of Franz Games. I run SWB Online, FedCom Online, and Starfleet Warlord. Just remind how to join us for a talk guest every Thursday night starting at 9:30 p.m. Eastern Time. You can either call on the phone system 605-562-0444. Just follow the directions. The call ID is 17702. Or you can participate on the web. Just go to the Talk Show website at www.talkshow.com. Search for call ID 17702. Or search for SFU on call or Starfleet Universe on call, and you will find us there. And of course, if you want the best online experience, what you want to do is you want to go to twitch.tv at twitch.tv/SFU on call, and you will find us there. You will watch the beautiful live stream of my face and other things. Well, my screen, not the other parts of my body. Just to let you know that. And of course, you can join the chat room. So, moving forward, if you need to contact me for any reason, my email address is sfuoncall@gmail.com. It's sfuoncall@gmail.com. Also, if you want to follow me on the Twitters or X or whatever they're calling it these days, you can follow me on the podcast account. That's sfuoncall. Also, a personal account is Paul Franz, P-A-U-L-F-R-A-N-Z. There's no T in that. And, of course, also my business account, Franz Games, at FRNZG, also there's no T in that. And of course, this lovely TalkCast, Guest Tunnel Podcast, available on iTunes and various other feeds around the net. ADB is still working hard on trying to find a replacement for Shapeways, and that's pretty much all the news from ADB. But this week on Fine Online Store, something that is at this point pretty old. And for those of you, it was a temporary thing, which was Starfleet Times. Currently, they offer the one through five. They offer packs of like five of them for $7.95. These were distributed during the interim, you know, when basically ADB and Tasmanware Games decided to split. But you know, this is the only thing that because of Tasmanware Games was a distributor of all products from ADB, at least that was the agreement, ADB could not publish anything. But to keep interest, Tasmanware Games allowed ADB to create what was called Starfleet Times. They produced around, 30 or 40 of these different kind of newsletter kind of things. And now they're available for you to buy in packs of five. Also, if you want to, these are also available as ebooks. But if you want the hard copies, like some of us like hard copies of games, in this case, it's not a game, but it's a newsletter. They have Starfleet Times number 1 through 5. This is $7.95 for all five of the Starfleet Times. Number 1 is Gordon Ryman Fast Cruiser, the first draft of the custom ship design system. Yikes. I'm sorry, nightmares from I think it was the S3 rules. Okay, also, Tholian IC Maulers, which is interesting because Tholian IC never had Maulers. The D5 Squadron SSD and also a monitor scenario. That's on number 2. Number three has the Ryman Saberhawk SSD, CDS expansion rules, which that's for the Andro, the Frax, the Windfish, and the Saltorian. Number 4 is actually a humor edition, including weird ships from the Orions, Klingons, and Winds. And number 5, this is a good one, Tournament Spotlight, including tactics for the new ships added in 1995. Yes, I did say that. 1995. That is almost 30 years ago. We got that right? Yeah, 30 years ago. It's actually, right now, 29. But, you know, as I said, almost 30. So, to say the very least, it is old. Did not realize how long ago that was. But anyway, moving onward and forward to SFB Online Tournament, the Sapphire Star 18 Tournament, we have signups. We have 13 signups. Only 3 more slots, people. So, if you want in, sign up now. Sign up quickly. Because soon enough, all 3 slots will be taken. The tournament will start, and boom, and then you can, in theory, can sign up as being an alternate, or you can just wait for the next tournament to start. I did sign up myself, just to let you know, because, you know, it was taking so long for people to actually start signing up, so I signed up myself. I will talk about what ship I have after all signups are done, and then so that everybody will know at that point. Moving onward and forward, when it comes to library reports, there's no updates, nothing new from for the SFB side or the FedCom side. As I mentioned before, the FedCom side, I did add the gunboat ships a few weeks ago. So if you didn't hear about that, actually, it's been announced. I announced it on Facebook. I don't think I announced it on the bulletin board. Yeah, the bulletin board for FedCom. I did do it for multiple groups on Facebook. So it has been announced, including actually Chris Newsy. He also did the same. So with that is the news for this week. And it's me, it's the Little Puffins, welcoming you to Star from the Universe on call. And tonight, we've got Doug. Say hi, Doug.
Hello.
And of course, driving down the roads of life, we have Jeff. How you doing, Jeff?
Good evening, everybody.
Okay, and don't mind me, people. It's, you know me. You've been here long enough. You'll know that at the beginning, I usually get my Twitch stream set up over there so I can actually see what I'm doing. Make sure everything's working. I can see what I see. Actually, I apologize greatly. I apologize for last week. I'm hoping that the same thing is not happening this week because my video seems a little jerky at the moment. Before I do anything too crazy, let's just go like this. Let's go show. Oh, I always hate this. It always seems to put it at the back. Okay. Vocally, it looks fine. I'm hoping at least the recording is fine. Because streaming still looks a little jerky. So that was actually one thing I found out with last week's recording, which was I saw jerky over here on Twitch. I'm like, okay, maybe it's just streaming and all that kind of thing. You know how buffering occurs and all that kind of thing. But no, I actually recorded it like that. So it's like, oh, man. So that's why I posted up on YouTube instead of release. I'm sure it's not exactly the best quality. Now, the audio was fine. It was just a video, which to me, I go by Leo Laporte's saying on that. It's better to have better quality when it comes to your voice than it is the quality of the actual video. Because most people listen, they don't watch. And my guess, when it comes to YouTube, most people are just listening and not watching me. Except for in the cases where I say, okay, this is one that you need to be watching. Which happens every once in a while. Hey, when I do my games, which, just to let you know, I have signed up for Sapphire Star 18. We have 3 more slots available. For those of you who already listen to the news portion, you already know that. By the way, so we have 3 slots. Still available, and hopefully we'll get the up and going very quickly, and I'll be announcing. Come on, sorry, and my Ravens are losing to the Bengals 14-7 at halftime. Come on, you can you gotta get out, you gotta beat them. Anyway, okay, go. And actually, believe it or not, people, Doug's actually having technical difficulties, so we switched to and the fallback plan, which is he calls me, I call TalkShoe, and I merge them together as a single call, and then voila, we've got Doug, because his internet is very wonky at the moment, and we'll not discuss that at this moment in time. But
wonky, wonky, wonk, wonk.
Thank you for sharing.
Sad trombone.
Thank you for sharing your wonkiness. Wah, wah. Now, moving onward and forward, the topic for this evening, it might be short. If it's short, then we'll come up with another topic. But the one which I saw posted on the discussion board, which actually, the funny thing is, I actually did a search tonight before to find this one. Originally, I couldn't find it. Then I found it by looking at the last week, because I knew I was doing my best this past week to, if I look, found an idea, write down the idea on my phone and say, okay, I have a note saying, okay, ideas for this week. So I might actually have more ideas than, because I'm a little peek behind the scenes. A lot of times I don't come up with topics until like, oh, the day of. So I'm trying to my best to do just a tiny bit, little more forethought on this. So actually there's one I want to do, but that's going to take some time and some work, which is Call to Arms. So I think I've done one on Call to Arms, but I want to read up on the rules and so forth, and probably and possibly play some of Call to Arms. Maybe I gotta check to see if Call to Arms. I know Call to Arms is meant for miniatures and basically hexless. I'm not sure if you can play it with hex based. I hope you can, because that'd be great. The idea being that I like the idea of like what Stormata does, which is simplified the playing and the rules and so forth of SFB. You know, it gives you the feel of SFB without all the rules of SFB. Now, obviously, Stormata, there's certain rules that don't exist in it that do exist in Starfleet Battles. Because it's, you know, trimmed down. And that's because you want to go to most complicated. You got SFB, then you have FedCom. After FedCom, I think you have Stormata. After you have Stormata, you have, or Klingon Armada, then you have Call to Arms. When it comes to simplifying tactical combat, because F&E is a different, is also a combat system, but it's not a tactical combat system. Well, yeah, it's not really a tactical combat system.
No, not at all.
Not at all.
It's not tactical at all. It's entirely strategic.
Right. Exactly. So, you know, and I'd like to go through Call to Arms. But I know that's going to, as I said, it's going to take me a bit of time. I have to sit down, learn the rules, test, you know, play through the rules. Because that's one thing that I was able to do at Gamers of Summer, which I actually got to play through a couple turns of Stormata to actually understand how it all works together. Because you need to do that so you actually can explain it. Because unless you actually played it, you can't explain it. It's one of those crazy things. And I like to do the same for Call to Arms. You know, I really would, because to me, I'm looking for the simplest version of SFB. Take away all the details of SFB, because I know SFB is it's absolutely gorgeous when it comes to details. For an engineer, the engineers just like me love those details. They make it, in my mind, it makes it more realistic. You know? And that's one of the things
Yeah. I'm sorry.
It's okay.
This is like the over-detailing in SFB is where you get that mission creep and that whole just bogging it down thing.
Oh yeah, it can be very bogged down.
Because it's really kind of it's still kind of a strategic-ish game, more than really. I mean, it's tactical, but it's just kind of in an odd spot between really tactical and strategic because of the abstraction. That's where it is. That's what I'm trying to get at. So it's an abstracted tactical game. But when you get into trying to over-engineer it, that's like, oh my gosh, that's where you end up with like the massive bogging down of everything.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but
I'm sorry, go on.
That's fine. But as an engineer, I love those details. That's one of the things that I really loved about SFB to start off with. Now, remember, folks, boys and girls, children of all ages. sorry, I started laughing because I learned SFB. This was 1980. I think it was either 84 or 85. I think it must have been 84, because I remember in 85, that actually was my first co-op. No. My first co-op actually was, well, no, it was 86. So I must have learned it in 85. I think it was my sophomore year at Drexel University is when I learned it. It was 85, 84, 85. When I learned it. But anyway, back in those days, you did not have computers. You did not have the computers to do all of this wonderful graphical stuff. It was pretty, as you know about 8-bit graphics. That's what it was. You know. And you had very limited
characters by 25 lines.
Yep. And you had very limited computers. Very limited computers. As they said, 640K is all you needed. Actually, this, I forget if that was even before that. No, it was about that time, yeah. Which was nuts. Come on. When the first computers I had, but actually, my first one I ever used had 8K. No, actually 4K. I think it was 4K. Yeah. It was a Heathkit H8 with an H9 terminal that my brother put together for the Heathkit. And that one was interesting because invariably the problem with those kits was invariably you get it wrong. And then you have to take it into the Heathkit shop. And they'd fix what you did wrong, what you soldered wrong or did wrong in putting together your computer. I'm not sure how much that cost because my father paid for it. But I remember going into the Heathkit shop and actually bringing it in and then them fixing it. And then my second one was the Commodore 64, like 64K. Hey, I was really going up in the world. And after that, then I got a 128K Mac. These are limited machines here, people. But anyway, so the whole idea of having rules that had that kind of level of detail was great because it made it very realistic for a board game. You know? So, yeah, I agree there, Aegis. Aegis was pointing out on the chat room, remember, we do stream on Twitch and you can talk to me via the chat in Twitch. And he was mentioning that when all players are well-versed in the rules, it runs really smoothly, and I agree 100%. This takes time and patience. In a second language to our... It is a second language to our gaming group now. yeah, that you can say that.
Funny how that happens.
Right, and the thing is, if you look at the rules for SFB, I mean, you really look at them, most of them are just the details of between the interactions between the different systems.
Yep.
You know? And so it just tells...
And they use congruent metrics.
Exactly.
The pieces interlock quite nicely. It's one of the reasons Starfleet Battles has the fans it does is because you don't have, the typical FOSSA solution to something where you've got 16 different ways to break the game and they don't care to fix it.
Well, you know, it's kind of funny about that is you were saying about when you first learned the game. Like, I was introduced to it back in the 83-84 time frame at my first duty station in the Army. And having to deal with Army manuals and thinking and all that happy stuff, reading the rules for SFB and learning how to play that was like, it actually was a good fit.
Yeah. If you got any experience reading mil-spec documents, it just fit. You just fit right in.
Yeah.
I found it in 92, and I had been doing a bunch of Civil Air Patrol stuff with my dad at the time. And
wow,
it's like, did they use the same contractor to print both of these manuals?
Hey, we all know that Steve Cole he's an engineer. He is an engineer.
Yeah. So professional courtesy, yes, engineers have to
go in together. True. Okay. Get back to the topic for this evening. Evany and Dragna. The one thing that he mentioned here, which was Jeff, in this case, Jeff Wiles was posting this, he's mentioning that, you know, the whole idea of This is a topic that basically got new life in the discussion board. It had been dead since 2021, which was interesting. Ah, and of course, back in 2021, who do we see? Gary Carney. And he talked about, okay, capital number also, okay. The original Juggernaut Dreadnought was presented in back in Capsule number one. Yes, this would represent the historical Juggernaut Alpha in a galactic octant, and possibly Juggernaut Primus, supposedly encountered by the Saturnian hive ship Star of Redemption in the Fire in the Deep short fiction in Capsule number 41. Then they introduced right. Juggernaut Beta or Juggernaut Secundus, as Fire in the Deep tells it, is covered by updated Dreadnought SSD and capsule number 33, and the dreaded Shriek missiles were also introduced. And capsule number 35 had a Juggernaut Heavy Cruiser and the Light Cruiser, while CL-41 presents the Juggernaut Battleship and Missile Dreadnought, which might or might not be represented by both Juggernaut Gamma and Final Deep's Juggernaut Tertius Destroyer and a frigate, plus a handful of red notes on the Juggernaut hull types. Just a quick mention of those. And that's kind of background material, because one thing I was mentioning is that he's mentioning here, in this case, Charles would mention that. So you have a situation where a big Dreadnought incursion could render a region of space more or less lawless. Basically, he comes to the idea of that these Juggernauts actually take over territory. And they sent the local government had the power and have not amassed the force to chase them out. But the civilian infrastructure is there intact, and little economic damage has been done, leaving an undefended zone of fat targets for anyone willing to risk running to a Juggernaut. And of course, it opens up some plots where you may be able to divert Juggernaut to enemy nations. But Jeff Wiles is just coming back and saying, hey, why not have a Juggernaut player option? And I look at Effany free-for-all scenario. Instead of a general war regular start, plays the Juggernaut fleet and a map attacking the Zindi and the Coalition. Then historically, each time an Empire was scheduled to be attacked, insert a new Juggernaut fleet, perhaps, with Charles manufacturing ships. Ah, okay, that's true. This one he posted on November 1st, said, too bad this wasn't suggested yesterday. It could have been worth a scary ship proposal. Though Mike Grafton mentioned that Dreadnoughts do attack civilians, which is fine. But it just comes up with the idea of that the Juggernauts as a, it's like almost Andro War. Andro War is way more extensive than this. But the idea of having, because I'm not even sure. I'll defer to Jeff on this one. Is there Juggernauts in F&E as like a monster, a random monster?
Not that I'm aware of.
Okay.
Not that I'm aware of. One thing, let's match terms. If I'm remembering right, the Juggernaut is effectively a giant space monster with a bazillion boxes to knock down. And as long as it has X number of boxes, it has Y number of weapons it can throw back at you in return.
Right.
That about right?
Mm-hmm.
So what reminds me, so what if I think of...
No, the Juggernaut. The Juggernaut is actually a ship, but it's a robot ship.
Right.
Right.
It's a robot ship that has that critical number six. The number four shield is not a shield.
It's right. It has that rotating shield.
Yeah, it was. Okay. No. The Juggernaut has it has five shields, and like where the number four shield was, you're just shooting up its engines. It's the Achilles heel for it. It was a scenario monster, and I think a very early Captain's Log.
Right. That's kind of what I remembered about it. It's been like 30 years since I've actually looked at the scenario for it. And even then, I was looking at fourth or fifth generation photocopies.
Yeah, the heavy weapons are something like phaser fours and then smaller ones, I think.
Right.
It's pretty vicious, and it's a four-player scenario to take it down, and it runs by automatic rules. I think we covered it under the monsters before, and if I recall correctly, they actually did a they did a publication where you could have like all the different several different sizes, like the different classes, like
which is what
frigate, cruiser,
I was bringing up with that Gary reminded us, which is number 30 Captain's Log number 35 had a Juggernaut heavy cruiser and a light cruiser, and 41 had a battleship, a missile dreadnought, a destroyer, and a frigate. Now, you know, a lot of the different Juggernaut, the quote unquote sizes of Juggernauts were covered.
Now, the premise was it was one of those extinct race things.
Right.
That was still wandering around and being a menace.
Right.
Well, the thing is, when you bring up...
Now, if you wanted to include it in F&E, if you wanted to include it in F&E, it wouldn't be that difficult to just say it's, you know, an equivalent whole class and so forth and so on. The issue is, you know, do you want to make it like a Berserker Fred Saberhagen kind of thing where there's a pocket of them that still exist and they go out and their mission is to destroy everything that's not them.
So, I'm going to bring up a different game from the 80s. Do you ever remember playing a board game called Ogre?
Yeah.
ORG.
Yeah.
And you have this basic ginormous death machine on one side.
Yes.
And it's got limited rules on what it can do. And then everybody tries to knock it down.
Yeah, Steve Jackson games.
It strikes me that you'd end up having the F&E version of a Juggernaut would play a lot like that. At least at the tactical level.
Very likely.
Mm-hmm. On the strategic level, it would be something like some kind of, well, when you get down to actual combat, when you're trying to chase it down and figure out where they're from, it'd be kind of like a snipe hunt. Can you bring enough ships to knock one down to a location where you can actually corner one? Or are they going to turn around and they're going to chew you up piecemeal until you can coordinate enough strength to smash them when you find them? It does seem to be like it would make a really good two or even three player scenario for a limited section of the general of the Alpha Octor.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I was actually to me the interesting idea was actually kind of taking Charles Gray their idea. And as kind of a small scenario, something like the four powers war, that kind of thing. Or
Right.
maybe something a little larger. The idea being that you have the juggernauts as one thing actually easy to point out is that there are man versions of the jugs as an option, by the way. You just mentioned that. But anyway, the idea being that the juggernauts as an empire actually it could be played with a number of juggernaut ships. Now, obviously, these ships would be quite powerful compared to the ships that were available. But I can see playing an F&E scenario where the idea is you're trying to the juggernauts are trying to expand out and kind of just wreak havoc throughout the map while you're trying to go around and trying to destroy the juggernauts. Now, and possibly even have the juggernauts have their own territory so they have can actually build up their own fleet.
You know, this reminds me of something that I wrote up back in the 80s for another game. Do you remember Soldier King at all?
Yes.
I think we played that at least once or twice at Gamers maybe a decade ago.
Yes, we did.
And in that game, they have a rule for rebels where like rebels pop up and they have their own little automatic rules where they like to try to take over provinces or areas, and then you have to go wipe them out. So, and I wrote up a variant where when the rebels pop up, a player could take over for them and try to run them as an additional faction. So if you had knocked somebody out of the game and rebels pop up, that guy could become the rebel leader and try to make a little comeback with it. But
That's neat.
yeah, see where we're going with that. But the thing about the juggernauts is they're a big monster, but they're still a monster scenario kind of thing. So I don't know. I just that would be a how deep of a dive do you want to go into on that? And what do you get back out of the game for playing it? I don't know.
It might
It could be
be
an interesting one.
a good idea to bring up one part of F&E's combat system that might not be familiar to people who've only played Starfleet Battles. Each combat is in a number of rounds, just like Starfleet or just like Starfleet Battles is in a number of turns. Ships have a com pop rating, a combat potential. Once you've done enough damage to that ship to it need its current com pop, you flip it over and it's crippled. Do it again, and of course the ship's destroyed. When it comes to bases, they have an incremental system where you can take a base down piecemeal rather than have to try to come up with 192 points of damage in one turn to knock down a star base. Excuse me, I don't remember exactly what the number is, but it's high, because if you're going to direct damage on a star base, it's three times the normal. You have to do three times as much damage for each point. But that's down in the weeds. The thing is that you'd probably end up doing something similar with the various juggernauts, is that they would be single entities, but each entity would have a number of incremental damage steps that you would have to slowly whittle down. It should probably be how the combat section of it would work. On the map, the strategic section is that they probably would exude a zone of influence that would disrupt logistic lines, making it harder for your units to stay in supply. Particularly if you've got if you've already got strain lines, can you imagine having only one base supplying your entire forward echelons? And, you know, the Kaventi swarming around the Klingons, and they just have the one base, it's their only supply node, supplying the entire Klingon fleet, and all of a sudden that hex gets attacked by a juggernaut and everything goes out of supply. Well, the Kaventi are going to have fun with that one. Klingons aren't going to like it much. It would be an interesting way to act like a big spoiler, like a negative attribute card in a number of games, like say Fortress America or in any of the other board games of that era, where you've got cards that can be either boons or curses.
Mm-hmm. Oh, and also another way of introducing juggernauts into F&E as a possibility, and this is one of those things that people who want to do it are interested in something, interested in that randomness factor, and that's only going to be certain people, which is the idea of course, juggernauts being a random monster, something like in SFD terms, critical hits. You know, it's an optional rule that people sometimes use just to make it a little more interesting. And you could do, in theory, the same thing with juggernauts. You could have your fleets going around the map. And if they run into they roll and they run into a juggernaut, then they have to fight with their current fleet. They have to fight out with whatever the juggernaut fleet is at that moment in time. It could be a single ship. It could be multiple juggernauts together and actually formed a fleet. The idea being there is that it actually would be strong enough to actually defeat a possible fleet that you have flying around the map. That's another thing that you could possibly do.
I just have a feeling that it could be potentially a massively annoying, unbalancing thing.
Right. Well,
if it drops in and just hoses over like one player at a particular time.
Yeah, and it's know. Also something, yeah, I can see that too, Doug.
It's like critical hits. How many people actually play with critical hits? Yeah. Probably nobody.
Yeah.
No, or next to nobody. And the only time people use it is just they want something different.
Oh, yeah.
I'm not saying that you should have this as part of, as a core part of F&E, you know?
Yeah. One of the things with F&E, though, is that the sheer amount of time that people put into it. It's like if you were doing, let's say we're just doing a casual pickup game on a Saturday afternoon of SFB tournament style, and we decided to play with critical hits. It's a few hours of our time, no big deal, you know. And if you get like that one critical hit that just ends the game, that's okay. We can restart. We can do it again. On the other hand, it takes a big chunk of time to set up F&E. You're usually looking at people playing large scenarios. Even the scenarios published in Captain's Log are quite involved. Yeah. And even though they can be small campaigns, they're like a whole day kind of thing and generally very well balanced. And something like that could really just completely skew it on one player. Now, on the other hand, if you have some kind of thing where you're throwing wandering monsters in, like where it's going to affect kind of evenly across the board And it's going to be a little thing that's not a big distraction that doesn't take a bunch of time to deal with. That's a different thing. And I could see a Juggernaut being put into the game that way. And, you know, it would simply be kind of a large unit that would take basically four cruisers to kill it, you know, in a fight. It can't run away once it's engaged. And they have to kill it. And if they don't kill it, it'll regenerate. And you could maybe have it where, you know, if it pops up in the game and it's in somebody's sector, it just disrupts the economics for that sector to some small degree. You know, the player that owns it loses a point or some, loses an economic point or two, but they don't get their supply lines completely screwed up.
Well, there are already rules in F&E for the disruption of the economics in a sector because of enemy action. I assume
it would be like having a hostile player ship in that sector.
Right.
You know, so. And until you go out and you kill it.
Yeah.
So that would be one possibility.
I think the easiest way to have it in an F&E type scenario would be to take one player and one empire, and you only play in that empire, and that empire is trying to deal with an infestation of juggernauts because there is a manufacturer that has landed in the Alpha Octant. You've got to find it, and you've got to put a stop to it before juggernauts overrun your empire. And that way it is only one-sided. There's no third party spoiler to come in and take advantage of. And that would probably be about the only way to make it really fun and fair in F&E, where it's the monster versus the empire chosen.
They might have something like that for like a solo solitaire play thing. You know,
that actually probably wouldn't be a bad idea for a solo F&E thing, because there's not a lot of solo type stuff you can do with F&E. You really do need somebody to play against.
Very true.
Yeah. Well, that's the line of the game.
But, What you brought up with takes all that time to set everything up and get started, and all of a sudden you've got the monster of the week beating up on only one side, making things very unfun for somebody. It reminds me of something else. Years ago, when I was far more active in the SCA, who was the original HEMA enthusiasts, one of the things that the combat archers used to get a lot of gripe for is you spend all this time and effort and money getting ready to go to the war. You show up at the war, and within 5 seconds of somebody crying, lay on, you get knocked out by an arrow, and you got to sit the rest of the battle out. Nobody likes that.
Yeah.
That's why some of the kingdoms in the SCA allowed full contact kills on archers, where others were saying, look, those guys don't wear a lot of armor. As long as you get within 5 feet of them and tell them they're dead, they've got to retire. And so it's like, hey, wait a minute. This guy's knocked out half my crew, who I can't have fun with now on the cleanup side of things, and I can't whap them? What the heck? Yeah, the SCA is an entirely different beast today than it was back then. That's all I'm going to say on that one.
Understood.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think, you know, definitely some good ideas. And the one other, one thing that came to my mind, which is basically a monster scenario. In other words, like SFB, but you have one player is playing whatever empire, And then they're trying to attack and destroy these juggernauts, and the juggernauts are playable, are a player driven empire. And instead of having normal ships, you have juggernauts. You know, and you're fighting along this border in F&E. You know. And play that like a monster scenario. But in F&E. The idea it's just for fun, and it's for the same reason that people play monster scenarios in SFB when there's actually the monster is controlled by a player, because as Doug and I found out when we were going through the monster scenarios, some of them have automated systems, some of them don't. Some of them actually require another player to play the monster.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you could throw that idea out to like Chuck Strong and all those guys that play that, I think. See what they think about it. But I think there's probably a pretty good reason why they don't have monsters included in the game.
Monsters are too ephemeral, really. And it probably
just has to do with...
Right, and...
Yeah, and it's something that's usually dealt with a small number of ships.
Yeah, the only kind of...
doesn't really fit in the scope of that game, I think.
I mean, I can sort out in my head how I think a juggernaut would fight with the F&E combat system, but short of having some scenario where you're trying to chase down, localize and chase down a juggernaut base before it disrupts your trade systems to fairly well, I don't really see how it could work. If you're doing an invasion of a strategic scale of a monster race, for lack of a better way to put it, that might work. But if it's just a singular monster, each turn in F&E is 6 months. That's it's just too abstracted out. Because most monster fights even the way the monster fights are in Starfleet Battles, unless you're running some kind of weird campaign and the monster wins the first three rounds, it's not gonna take more than a week, more or less, for the monster to be tracked down and dealt with. Even if it means stripping the defenses of everything in three sectors to come beat up on it.
True.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think it wouldn't really fit well in the scale of it.
No, it just doesn't.
Okay. Reading an old post that got posted in 2008, and the thread died out to 2021 again. Big surprise. Okay. Whatever. Okay. Might as well bring it up, which was the. An idea. Now, I'm not sure how many people realize this, and that is, overall, I'm not the greatest UI developer in the world. Therefore, any ideas for games and so forth, I want limited UI interaction, limited UI design. You know, so there's one idea, and I've gone back and forth in my head about it, and not sure if it's just one of those ideas that just, you know, like, no one will be interested. I was it's possible that nobody would be interested. But at the same time, the biggest thing is here, okay, let me just bring it up. The idea is, now, for those of you who are my age, you'll remember this game called Zork. So, everything, and shocker for you youngsters, everything was text. There were no pictures. It was just text. And actually, there's quite a few engines that currently do handle that right now, which is help you to create games like Zork. I was actually really interested in trying to create one. I did some research. Actually, do I still have that one? I think I do. It might be over there. It's that, or I tossed it. I'm not sure.
Yeah, there's a whole bunch of them out there. Twine is one engine I've heard of. Then there's one that's popular with people who build visual novels called RenPy.
Right. There's interactive fictions. You know,
they're all over the place. Yeah, they're all over the place.
Right. And interactive fiction is nice. Actually, there was one that I found which was very graphically oriented, browser-based, and so forth. And the thing is, it's really, I feel like it's select your own adventure kind of thing, more to the point. You know, it has some certain capabilities, but they're very limited when it comes to, at least for that one engine. Other ones are quite good and just take a bit of development. Now, so basically, it's kind of like interactive fiction, but not, let's stick with that. Now, the idea of this is basically a multiplayer Zork. And that is that you would start, it would be text-based. Might have some graphics that could pop up here and there. Start simple. Totally text-based. And the person would enter the dungeon, quote-unquote dungeon, because at the moment I'm just calling it dungeon because it simplifies things.
Well, you realize, of course, you're talking about the classic era of the internet with the multi-user dungeon or MUD.
Mm-hmm.
And yes, I know I've just showed my age.
Yeah, because I never...
We're doing on Telnet in the 90s.
Right. Exactly that was the whole... And the question is, the biggest issue for me, especially in this day and age, which is, what's the difference between that kind of thing, a multiplayer Zork or a MUD, and chat rooms?
The only real difference between the two, is that chat rooms tend not to have a character tree system, any sort of combat system, or any other sort of extensive map, and put that in air quotes if you like, for you to travel around to various locations that can be described textual. Chat rooms tend to have just a couple of different locations and everybody dumps out in the same place and everything else is just freeform text from the participants, whereas a MUD as commands you throw out and anything that would require dice or anything like that rolls through their internal randomizer to pull out results. It also tends to have a much larger locations listing and additional spaces set aside for the descriptions of various locations, items, people, and things, and so on and so forth. So a chat room is, you could think of a chat room as a Bud Light, but it doesn't really work that way in reality. It's the difference between It's the difference between using a pickup to go pick somebody up from school and using a car. You can do both, but the pickup truck get to do.
What? Sorry, my cat was interesting. Okay, that's.
Were you under attack by the cat?
Yeah. Okay, it looks like there's some out there already. I have to look at them some more.
So what were you wanting to put on this this multi-user textual thing?
Oh, jeez. Well, first I wanted to make sure that the idea that wasn't crazy, and it sounds like it's not that crazy. Now, okay. At one point, actually, I thought about basically. I actually own a domain called sfuadventure.wiki. The idea of that domain was, you know, and I probably never get around to ever implementing because I'm getting to that point in my life where I'm just getting too old. And unless I actually retired today. Whoops. You're back.
Yes, I'm back.
But the idea originally that I had for that was that. Yes, Jeff?
I'm trying to turn it off. I thought it was tap to raise your hand, tap again to lower your hand. Sorry about that.
Yeah. I tapped it to lower your hand. Okay, but we're back. With that original idea with an adventure wiki. Now, we all know the issues with wikis.
Okay.
Which is those people that you trust to actually add content to the wiki, you have to trust them not to be malicious in that content that they add. But
or ghost you.
Yeah, they could do all kinds of slimy things, from pornography to vile content thing. Oh, this person's awful, or you know, the language used and so forth, that kind of thing. You have to be very trusting in that. And invariably when it comes to wikis, usually they have they are versioned so that anytime that happens, they can go, okay, this person was malicious, roll it back to what was the previous version.
Right.
But anyway, the idea would be that, you know, I could start it, or, you know, in this case, my initial SFU adventure was kind of dungeony. But instead of being in a dungeon, you're being in a starbase. And then you can go around the starbase. And run into people and do things and so forth. Obviously, adding objects and things like that and adding characters, or actually adding objects, possibly adding characters. I'm not sure characters, possibly even objects. The idea was that, you know, other people could be, I could start it and I could add to it, but also people could then start playing it and go, okay, you know, I really would like to flesh out this part of the starbase. Like maybe, well, let's say the engine room or
it would be engineering on a starbase, not an engine room.
But. Right. Things like that where, you know, I give people the ability to actually expand and add detail or maybe expand to other parts, like the starbase. You could start maybe portal, and you can, if you go down to the right, you have the admiral's office, and you keep on going down, you have the mess hall, you know, things like that. If you turn at the end of the hall, if you turn right, you do this. Turn left, you go here, you know, that kind of thing, and start adding to it, you know, and then a part of the wiki. What's that?
Oh, this sounds like a great subject for like a long day of talking. If you want to come up sometime.
Mm-hmm.
But
it kind of reminds me of a computer game from the 16-bit era. Oh gosh, circa 1989, 1990, where you had a walking adventure, Zork-like adventure kind of thing on the Starship Enterprise that was actually fully licensed. I don't remember the specific name of it, but it was, it really struck me as what you're talking about now.
Mm-hmm.
Similar.
Well, it sounds like what you're looking for is an open world where people can design the elements for you.
Right, or at least add to it, you know.
And you want to have it so they can go in and do their own design of different sections and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But the problem that I would see would be, how do you limit it so that somebody works on a section of it and somebody else doesn't come along and just mess up their stuff?
Right, right.
You know, does it come in and alter something? And, right. Well, and people get annoyed with each other about that.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah, typical wiki drama.
Right. That's why I point out part of the wiki you have to have is a version. It has to be versioned. In other words, it can be, if it's something malicious or maybe not malicious.
And the other big question is, have you ever seen where anybody's tried to do that before?
I don't know.
I was considering that as a potential game design thing for an online game someday. If I ever have like the cash to do something. But I was thinking more along the lines of like a big open world thing, like with an actual world. And you know what? This sounds a lot like it's been done and it's called Minecraft. Because you could build a server and say, right, here's all the Lego bits, however you design the world for the Lego bits, and here's what you can do, here's the toolkit you can use. But the issue is, you know, if you're doing it in a Starbase environment, that's kind of limited. Even if you make it a huge Starbase, and the question is, how many people go in what different random directions? And I don't know, it could be an interesting experiment. Could be very interesting.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's got potential. There are some potential drawbacks, mm-hmm, and design considerations you might want to go in for.
The toughest part in my mind is getting people involved and having it so it's exciting, and people and it actually will grow.
Oh, you know what? You know what else? Actually, this just popped two words into my mind: Dwarf Fortress. Remember that?
Yeah, I know Dwarf Fortress, and
that might not be too. Yeah, I mean, that's kind of an example, but it's like there is the existing world there that people went out, they did their things in it, they died in it, their stuff was still there, the stuff they built was still there. You know, so on and so forth. Then it was a continuing, it basically built on itself.
Yeah.
But as far as like having people come in and design sections of the Starbase for you, I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
You'd probably end up having to do something like the way they used to, the more social MUDs that they would do is they would give people who are interested in building, they would give them an anchor seed, and that anchor seed would be a location ID in the database, and they would build everything off that anchor seed, and anything they built would be flagged as their possession. Nobody else could edit it unless they had super user privileges. And then they could link that with permission to various public areas. You'd have to do something like that would go a long way towards dealing with the wiki stuff. The thing is that you'd also have problems where you have four different engineering departments, none of which are finished and all of which conflict with one another.
Right. Agreed.
And then you could have like people endlessly arguing about, you know, how many bits of antimatter does it take to make their engine room work? And then other people arguing about it. It's not an engine room, damn it, it's a starbase. You know.
Are you calling me out, Doug?
No, I'm just throwing that out.
I feel
out
like
there.
I'm being called out because I said something very much like that a little bit earlier.
No, it just fit. It was a form and function thing. Don't take that one personally.
Okay. Okay, I won't take it personally.
That's not a dig. It's not a dig. So, but you know, I'm saying it's like you could end up with like, oh, why do you have portholes in your lounge when your lounge is in the exact center of the starbase?
No. Well, that's where you put. That's where you hide the virtual screens behind the portholes, so that you can give people the illusion of a view outside. Duh. I saw that episode of Enterprise.
Yeah, it's got potential. It's got some issues. I think you need to flush out the idea a lot more, maybe on paper.
Right. Oh, agreed.
Like what is the, what's the end game? Is there an end game? What is the purpose of the build or the ability to build?
Mm-hmm.
You know, how do you have the adventure of time go for it within your space? There's a whole bunch of stuff that I've given thought to. I don't know. It's just one of those. I really think that maybe that's like a good. We could sit down and talk about that stuff sometime, Paul, kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
But.
Yeah, that would definitely be a good way to kill a six pack.
Oh, the six pack, that's an all day. That could be an all day thing, just to get the kickoff on what you want to do with it.
Right, right.
So,
yeah, actually, you got a good point there, which is basically, can you stop that? Ow! Cat has claws.
Obviously, they can't stop that.
Yeah.
Well, I'm sure they can. They just don't want to. They're like, oh, did that hurt? I'm so sorry. At least I got you to pay attention. Give me my treat. Feed me.
Man, Kazan wars continue.
Feed me, human.
Stay down there. But yeah, you got a good point there in that. What kind of actions or so forth? Because Doug, you're reminding me of obviously some of the games you play. I think not World of Warcraft. And then Eve Online. What's the other one that you play?
Wow,
that's it. Wow.
I'm mostly into Eve and WoW.
Right. But the idea of just like That is, you have to do certain actions to generate points or whatever you want to call them. And that allows you to do other actions. And in the case of this, I can see that being, okay, we have certain things which you have to go through the dungeon or the star base, whatever, and you have to find this, or this, or do this activity to help basically keep the base functioning and so forth. And because of, and for that, then you earn this number of points, which then you can build this many rooms because of that. The idea of that it encourages people to be in the system and playing around inside to earn the ability, to earn the right to actually build, to add on to the system, add what they want, or do something that they can claim as their own.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Interior designs, Starfleet version. Maybe.
Sounds more along the lines of the simulated Sims.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's actually not too far off.
The only thing that brings to mind is, and I hazard to mention it, are you aware of the ongoing controversy that may have been put to rest by now? I haven't been paying attention recently, of Stack Exchange getting their knickers in a twist over various things.
No. Other than possibly...
Okay.
AI
5 years ago, scraping Stack Exchange was the place to go if you needed help in a hurry on technical topics.
Right.
Because you could pick the right Stack Exchange for that topic, and you could pretty much talk with people that have a really good handle on the topic, and you would get more than one answer typically. And because of the way the kissing contest worked over there, the best rated answers would float up to the top. Well, what they ended up running into, and I'm talking before the AI stuff came out, mm-hmm. was it started becoming apparent that there were people who were playing games with their promotions system on the back end with the moderators and whatnot to boost their friends and attenuate their enemies. And then the whole AI, we're going to scrape the entire of Stack Exchange for AI answers to tell you to put blue on pizza as a topping. Just a little tidbit, wood glue is not a topping for pizza. I think there's still a skeleton of what was once there, but I think they've seen a mass exodus in the actual skilled people that used to go there to donate their time and effort to try to bring up the next generation of devotees to their chosen topics.
That's possible.
I end up having a problem kind of like that. If I'm going to turn around, I'm going to spend 6 hours grinding to get just enough points to bang out another bulkhead to make this one extra. Room, just one extra compartment. Am I the only one on this server?
Yeah, understood. But the idea is that you do not make it. You would not make the cost that so great that it's you feel like you're just sitting there and churning away, and you're getting no benefit from it whatsoever.
Of course, there's also the Among Us effect. What I've heard referred to as the Among Us effect. Among Us, that really goofy game that took the world by storm a few years back,
mm-hmm. yep.
where you've got a number of crew members on a ship that are tasked with doing menial tasks,
right.
and one imposter who tries to with everybody on the ship to win.
Yes, yes. And yes, the thing is,
yeah, it tries to sabotage the whole thing.
Yes. The thing is that you would end up sitting for 20 minutes in a lobby for enough players to gather to start the game. And as soon as he started the game, the saboteur was selected. Well, as soon as the screen came up and told you you were a crew member, you would see 64 people playing the game would drop down to 4 because everybody who wasn't the saboteur would bail. Like, wait a minute, what happened here? I just spent 20 minutes waiting for a game for this? And that's the side effect if the costs are too high for the grinding you got to do.
Right.
Yeah, I think the idea needs to be fleshed out a bit more.
Mm-hmm. Oh, agreed.
Like the core starting point and what you want people to do within it specifically. And then how do you mesh the whole thing together?
Right. Agreed. Well, we'll leave it there. Obviously, there's a lot more details that need to be worked out for it to be the idea of a world that actually would be expanded upon and built upon, and have it so people can enjoying building the universe. You know. I started thinking about the one thing that always is a problem with those universes, which is trust. You have to earn the trust of the players and people who are actually going to be inside the system. You know, in some cases, the whole idea of actually, strange as it might sound, exporting your data so that you might have done something really cool. And in some cases, when it comes exactly for this, which is it's a text-based environment, you might create some really cool prose that you want to export later. You've written it all up, and then you saved it, and that's the only place where it exists. And you'd like to actually export that and save it off someplace else, so you don't lose it ever.
Licensing terms is something you would require a hard look at too.
Yeah, that's always.
What kind of license do you, the manager of the system, require for the content posted by its users?
Right, which would be probably licensing would be that you own the text and so forth, but you give me rights to actually use the text and show it to others. That kind of thing, because I wouldn't want to actually own it. So, which means that if someone would want to acquire me and acquire the game, I'd say no, because all this text and all this whole world has been built. I don't own it. That my players, they own it. You know, the content is theirs.
It's one of those things that you gotta nail down before you really open to the public.
Agreed.
Yeah, yeah. That's really a sticky sticking point.
Yeah, and the thing about it is that you've got to make sure that there is a way for you to turn around and you can maintain the rights that you need to have to continue to do what you want to do while at the same time not painting yourself into a corner like several organizations have done over the years. Not to come back to it, but in the SCA, one of the things that participants can do is register a name and a coat of arms. Mm-hmm. And the College of Heralds is who you do this through. And the thing about it is that there was a lot of talk when I was active years ago about wanting to put the various coats of arms up on the web somewhere. And it was basically flat out told us We could put the description of the arms on the web, but we couldn't actually put the arms themselves on the web because the rights that we asked for, and when people were starting to sign all this stuff up, didn't attach that way. And generally speaking, most people didn't draw their own art anyway, which means we'd have to go to a third party to get their permission to put it up. It just turned into a huge Gordian knot that would enrich the lawyers and make everybody else the worst.
Yeah.
So it's one of those things. You've got to try to keep an eye towards what's going to happen. Okay, fine. Somebody shows up, user A goes in and structures a pretty interesting section of the base, a lot of very, very flowery prose.
Right.
And they want to pull that out and put it in a book or a short story or something, as long as they either have the rights from you to use your setting, the parts of it that you control, and the parts of it that other people have written that they control, or do you have any teeth in the agreement? Because if you don't, then somebody's just going to scrape it anyway, say an AI did it, and say, oh, I didn't do this. I just put this into an AI, and AI spit it out. And, you know, we're seeing that kind of thing now with all of the ways that certain firms in Asia are very light-fingered with IP, where they'll file off just enough of the serial numbers to get past automated content controls. Well, right now, I have a suspicion that if you looked hard enough on Temu and Wish and Alibaba or AliExpress, you could find look-alike, sound-alike, and taste-alike copies of just about everything name brand anywhere in the world.
Pretty much they're thieves.
Yeah.
But I'll say it, they're just thieves. And yeah, if it goes out there, they're going to steal it.
Yep. Okay. Well, that.
You guys still there?
Yep. I'm going to need to wrap it up here because it is getting late. It's already 5 after 11 my time. And of course, I still have to work tomorrow morning. So, Bob.
Okay.
It's been a pleasure having you around. We came up with a solution, old school, previous solution. Works. So you have a good night. Jeff, always a pleasure to have you around. I'm glad you were able to join us. It's always great. And you drive safely out there. Uh-oh. I think I lost everybody. Double check that. I actually have a mic. It's possible that everything else is recording. Okay. Just checking. Anyway, had a nice discussion. Actually, I had not planned on bringing that up, but I brought it up. But I think it's a great idea. Obviously, Jeff brings up an excellent point, which I never even thought of, which is the licensing issue. Be surprised. I'm not a lawyer, so I don't think about that. Sometimes I need to think about it more often than not. But anyway, in some cases I do think about it, but most of the time I hope I don't have to. Anyhow, with that, I am Paul Franz, and I bid you a good night.